un plat de hauteur et un plat de viande et une pomme de terre, s'il vous plaît. Pour dessert, je désire un poire. Merci, garçon. Katie alla au musée du Louvre et vit les peintures. Elle dit qu'elle était belle. Katie retourna à son hôtel et dit « Bonne nuit, maman et son papa. J'ai eu une bonne journée. Demain, nous en irons à la Suisse. » Le lendemain, ils allèrent en Suisse et vit la montagne. En deux semaines, ils allèrent à la mosquée. Katie alla à l'école. Elle est joyeuse d'être chez elle.
Okay.
La conversation par téléphone. Les personnages sont 1. Jean, 2. Mary, 3. Mère de Jean. Ring. Bonjour Mary, est-ce Jean? Oui, c'est moi. Comment allez-vous? Comme ci, comme ça. Mon frère cadet est malade. Il n'est pas venu à l'école lundi. Dîner, Jean, dîner. Bonsoir, Mary. Ma mère m'appelle pour dîner. Bonsoir, Jean.
Excellent. Va dîner, il aura des armes.
OK.
Le professeur dit, première, récitez les quatre saisons. Puis, écrivez une petite histoire avec les quatre saisons. Je dis, les quatre saisons sont le printemps, l'été, l'automne, l'hiver. Puis, au printemps, il fait chaud. Au printemps, l'école est finie. Au printemps, l'arbre tourne vert. En été, il fait très chaud. En été, je vais au car. En été, je vais nager. En automne, l'arbre tournait beaucoup de couleurs. En automne, l'école commence. En automne, il fait frais. En hiver, il fait froid. En hiver, le Père Noël venu à Noël. En hiver, voici la neige. Le professeur dit, il y a une faute. Vous dites, voici la neige. C'est voilà la neige.
Après l'école, je retourne à chez moi. Mon frère cadet Jean et mon petit chien Pierre attendent à la porte. Ma mère dit, comment allez-vous ce soir? Je réponds, comme si, comme ça, nous avons beaucoup de devoirs. Je vais dans ma chambre. Ma mère dit, dîner est prêt. Nous avons légumes, la pomme de terre, la salade et le lait. Je retourne à ma chambre. Je finis mon devoir. J'éteins la lumière. Je vais dans l'allée.
La conversation par téléphone.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Roger Brayon. Mon adresse est 323 Stuyvesant Avenue. Pourquoi?
Je m'appelle Georges. Mon adresse est 504 La Grande Rue.
Combien de garçons il y a?
Il y a 8 garçons.
J'ai ma mère et ma père, Dieu.
C'est tout le devoir de Française.
Oui.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Bonjour Roger. Bonjour Richard. Comment allez-vous?
Bien.
Et vous?
Très bien, merci.
Où allez-vous?
Je vais chez Jean.
Comment va-t-il?
Il est malade.
Pourquoi allez-vous chez Jean?
Parce qu'il veut parler à ami. Parlez bonjour quand vous allez chez Jean.
Pourquoi il est malade?
Parce qu'il se promena quand il fit froid. Je dois partir maintenant.
Au revoir, Roger. Au revoir, Richard.
J'entre le restaurant français. Je dis le garçon, apportez-moi la carte, s'il vous plaît. Je dis, apportez-moi le plat de viande, s'il vous plaît. Je bois le vin. Le garçon me donne la déchante. Je pars.
Until society meets the problem of housing. This then poses another problem for us in New York. Shall we view the school as an educational institution, reflecting the problems of the broader society, or do we see the school as a community institution, giving leadership to the understanding and solution of community problems? We hope today at this conference to explore roles which parents, educators, school administrators, boards, and community leaders must play in this current dilemma. How are our children affected by intergroup contact or lack of contact during their very early years and as they grow up? What impact does the family pattern have on the way the child relates to his world? How does school life relate to home life? What precisely are we to teach? Is the school, a school like ours particularly, an island of security where we and our children manage to avoid some of the harsher realities of life outside? Perhaps we can come up with some insights about this. We hope that each of you at the end of this day will feel that you have spent the day well and that you will leave with a feeling of urgent restlessness to continue thinking and working on these problems. In setting up a conference like this, we're always in a dilemma. We don't know what will suit most people. Today we chose what we think is a compromise, and we hope you'll be satisfied. We have arranged it so it will be possible for all of you to hear all of our consultants. Following brief discussion here, the group will separate into four workshops, each one led by one of the consultants. You can choose the workshop that most closely meets your interest. In introducing the first speaker, I'm reminded of a story or an article I read many years ago of the reminiscences of a country school teacher who was describing the difficulties he had in sparking his children who had so little experience with life. And he said the one thing that really got them was a story of around the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln. And then he said in commenting, I suppose it's because in our society, the most pushed around segment are the children. Well, I think the children of our city have been particularly fortunate in having a champion. I would say a liberator of children. The name Cornelia Goldsmith is almost synonymous with nursery schools in New York. And I think that we're very lucky to have one of the best fighters for standards in nursery schools, a real battler. And I'm delighted that she could be with us.
Didn't come prepared with my wartime feathers. But I'm very glad to be here. And I'm still really very much under the influence of last evening. I think anyone who was here last evening had a sense of something so vital and so profound and so genuine and so broad that any of us that are interested in what we call intercultural living integration found his own meaning in what was said. For me, there was very deep meaning. As an educator, it gave me a feeling of standing high and holding up my professional head as an educator. And we don't have this opportunity to get this feeling as often as we might. The status of education, in the terms that Mr. Britton described with such humility, such simplicity, such frankness, an event that reached the headlines that went around the world. He had, as I said to the person who sat next to me last night, doesn't take long to have confidence in the things such a man believes. He was able to say, I did certain things which would have required more than a champion, I think, would have required really a tremendous courage. And he said simply, although I'm not a brave man, I did thus and so. To me, when he said, it didn't seem right, these are not his exact words, and I was glad to see the words were recorded, it didn't seem right to teach civics in the classroom and not live what we taught outside of the classroom. He also had this thing that I call wholeness in concern for any cause. And this is really my theme of whatever I'm going to say today. His wholeness related to his devoted, dedicated concern to the educational work of the high school and the pupils within it. But the threads that went from these pupils to their families couldn't be separated, and he worked with the families. They were kept informed, and he saw the families as part of his small community. And he also saw that the law of the land must be the law we obey, whether we personally agree with it or whether we don't. So that his scope was broad, was deep, and was quite all-inclusive, made one feel whole. The question that I've been asked to talk briefly on is the young child. The young child is the child that for the many long years of my long life have meant most to me. There is peculiar significance in the young child who is actually coming into his or her own in our current era. And it's happening because no matter from whence, no matter from which profession we look, if it's a profession concerned with the growth and development of people and their relationships, these young years are increasingly of significance. This is true in the teaching field, it's true in the psychiatric field, it's true in the social work field, it's true in analysis, in pediatrics, in mental health. we are coming to the fact that the place to begin is at the beginning. And here I think we need really a very firm exclamation mark. Where is the beginning and why? And if we were to talk just about this question of relationships, which is at the root of any intercommunicating, any intercultural, interfaith, inter-anything between people, we would have to really understand how people do communicate and where and when and why they begin. I'm convinced that communication begins when life begins. Communication isn't necessarily through words or sound, it's through feeling as well. And the feeling of a child in a family as to how he is valued, to a great extent conditions how he values others. And the way in which that communication, before words, begins, does affect him for his life, in a way. But something new happens when this little infant born into a family gets up on his hind legs and begins to propel himself in his own direction. He's no longer being carried and put, he is directing himself. And when he learns the other skill of speech, he is no longer cooing and echoing sounds as such, which begin to have meaning, but he is expressing his thoughts, his own thoughts. And it's at this time, when he is on his hind legs upright, and when he is moving out of his confinement within a family, that he is pulled as though by a magnet. He is urged from within to associate with other children. You watch children in the park and you see they have no regard for introductions. They go, they meet, they mingle. I think any of us who are here today would be in complete agreement that no child born on this earth is born with a prejudice. This, I think, is clear. Prejudice comes from somewhere. I think the other angle that causes us consternation when we have children in a school of this kind or are interested in intercultural living is the fact that we feel guilty if we have any prejudice as an adult. And yet, I've never met an adult that didn't have some inkling of prejudice hidden somewhere. I think we've all grown up with some prejudice. I think the important thing is not that we deny it, not that we try to beat it down, but that we become aware of it, and that we prevent the thing that is really a contagion of prejudice, that we stop the contagion from moving, particularly to the very responsive, very dependent young children. With the birth of each of whom, we have a new beginning, a new opportunity, a new chance to do the protection of the unprejudiced child, to defend that. We have much to learn from the young child. And by watching the young child's reactions, we can become increasingly aware of when and how and why we seem to inject something called a prejudice. It's only when we become aware of our own prejudice that we can become aware of the child's lack of prejudice and eager moving forward to people, to his peers, to others like himself. And he disregards caste, economic level, skin color, religion, background. Here is a person. And he wants to know this person. And there should be opportunity for exchange freely between young children without hampering. I'm reminded sometimes of what it seems to me we have done in education that, with the best intention in the world, has been harmful. We've taken children in the past, certainly within my lifetime, perhaps not within the lifetimes of many of you, we've dedicated ourselves to segmentizing our approach to children. We've taken him very neatly apart. We've taken the child's intellectual achievements and handed them over to the school. Now you handle his intellectual development, dear school, say we. We have taken his physical person and given it to the medical field and have said, now will you deal with this child's physical being and see that he is well. And we have taken his spiritual being and given it to the church or the synagogue and asked them to do with the spirit whatever needed to be done. The social aspect we sort of left to haphazard happening. And it wasn't until we had separated this child so neatly and developed all our specialties, our very intensive specialization which has taught us so much, that we discovered something which we began then to call the whole child. We discovered the whole child, and we tried putting him together again. We found that every aspect of his living affected every other aspect. We found that the specialists found they had limitations because certain aspects were under somebody else's regime. But as each specialty expanded, there were overlappings, difficulties, and we are in a position today where we are necessarily having to learn about each other's professions and their contributions, and we're developing something called the team approach. Everywhere I go, I meet teams of people drawn from the various specialties, putting pieces together, trying to get at what is significant in this whole child. But this is giving the whole child much greater status and synchronizing him in the way he is synchronized. I think we now realize that the whole child goes with himself wherever he goes. He never leaves himself behind or any part of himself. He may behave a little differently on Sundays than he does in the playground, but he's still the same child. His motives are the same. We may dress him up differently. He may learn to speak differently and respond differently. He's the same child. And within himself, the things he cares about, the things he likes, the things he resents, and the things he's hostile about are the same within him. In one way, this simplifies our problem greatly. But I think, in a sense, we have also separated ourselves according to skin color, if you will. And we think of groups as being apart. And our whole effort here is now toward wholeness, toward the thing again that children know and the way that children live together. But we're having, with our separateness, we are needing to bring ourselves together, to find the way to synchronize ourselves, to get at the basic fundamental human values. I was very much interested when this whole southern flare-up explosion in some of our southern communities occurred, that my daughter, who is in Afghanistan for 2 years, wrote saying she had seen the headlines in the newspapers about what was happening in Tennessee. And she felt proud to be an American. I read on, and she stated, this sort of caste living, this sort of segregation of minority groups goes on over the whole wide world, and in very few places are people acknowledging that it exists or coming to grips with it, even though it means a kind of explosive behavior in order to begin to deal with it. This, I thought, probably had great truth in it. And as you think of people living around the world, it is probably everywhere true. We have a particular responsibility because we believe in democracy, and we cannot speak in terms of democratic living and not live it. The time has come that we are going to live it. Now, the young child, again, may I say, is the crucial child if we want to preserve his native wholeness, his native talent for socialization, his native interest and concern for other people. In order to help him do this, we adults, who have worked so hard in trying to grow up well as the culture expects of us, demands of us. We've lost something that must be recaptured. We've lost the flavor, the excitement, the newness of a first experience. The first experience between children in their first going to school, in their first meeting of their peers in a repeated day-by-day living situation is something that can't be repeated. No new experience can ever be repeated. I saw a man at a lunch counter last week order a cup of coffee, and after he had ordered it, he put his hat and coat on, started to the door, and then he came back and said to the waitress, "I'll have another cup, please." And he sat down and drank his second cup. And finally he looked at her and he said, "What's the matter? Why does the second cup never taste the same as the first?" And I couldn't help but say in a whisper across the counter, "Because it isn't." It isn't the first. And a second is never the first. A first is something so special. And young children have so many firsts. And with each first experience, particularly in relation to people, comes this flavor of newness, of exploring, of adventure, of meaning that you can never recapture, because after a while we become relatively dulled to first experiences. Partly we don't have so many. We've lived so long and we've done these things so repeatedly and we've met so many people and we take certain things for granted. The first time something happens, this is never true. I think if we look back at our own lives and counted the significant experiences in our lives, there would be many firsts among them. But we have to learn somehow, in spite of the long effort of growing up, to put ourselves back, to be able to place ourselves in the position of the young child, lacking experience, lacking historical background, and being natively, genuinely, freshly outgoing toward other people. And to the extent that we can keep this for him, we will gain, and the child will gain. I was interested in thinking about intergroup, intercultural, to look into my little favorite volume called The Dictionary. I don't read it every day, but now and then I do, to see how many inters there were. And the inters in the dictionary, the new inter words, were just amazing. To me, to have this much common usage in the dictionary of inter, let me just read some of these to you, were fascinating. We have words now that we use in common parlance: interracial, intercultural, international, interprofessional, interdisciplinary, intercommunicate, interrelationship, interact, interreligious, interdenominational, interfaith, intergrow, interjoin, intermingle. I question a little bit our use of intercontinental today, but maybe we'll get over it. And on to interplanetary. And inter is a recognized word. Inter is defined as among, between, together, mutual, reciprocal. In other words, it means the thing that I said originally as my theme for the afternoon: wholeness, togetherness, expansiveness. And the way we can deal with it best, in my opinion, is to take ourselves where we are as adults, here and now, and to work with our children where they are, and to use each opportunity where we have influence or responsibility for a young child, to help that young child retain the values that he has that we now really need to learn. I'm asking us to try to learn from children. We don't have to battle for them if we let them.
Thank you. She doesn't sound like it, but she is.
Then I'm kind.
Mary Beaucamp doesn't look like a professor. And I think she's not a traditional professor. Traditionally, we thought of the teacher in the classroom, or the professor in the university, who seriously worked with students, and that was where his job ended. But looking through magazines and newspapers during the past year, it is rare that one goes through it during any one month and not find the name of Mary Beaucamp in some connection, meeting with some intergroup committee in New York City or speaking at some conference. We're very pleased that the Center for Human Relations at NYU is represented in the person of Mary Beaucamp, who has had experience in the elementary schools and who has been working particularly in the intergroup field in the past several years. I'm delighted that she's with us, and I hope that she can throw some insights into some of the problems that we are facing in this particular school as we work with intergroup relations.
I was so interested in what Ms. Goldsmith was telling us about that I just wished that she could go on speaking, because I have been quite troubled about what I could say to a group like this that would have some real meaning for you, because you have already taken your stand, I think, in the fact that you're here today, the fact that many of you, your parents, send your children to this school, and the teachers are teaching in this school. I'm also a little bit in the position, I think, of a person referred to by Abe Martin when he said, if you want to tell somebody, if you want to get rid of somebody, tell him something for his own good. I think that when you get yourself in this kind of position of speaking to people, this often can be the interpretation that people carry away. I do not know the answers to any of these debatable questions that we have. And I would just like to pose some principles which it seems to me we need to think about as we try to answer these questions. I have sat in on a great many intergroup meetings of one kind or another, and it seems to me sometimes that we're sort of getting ourselves sidetracked on a great many issues that may be leading us down some blind alleys. I was interested in hearing Ms. Wolf read the statement that segregated education is inferior. And it made me think that, yes, that's true. But this does not necessarily say that integrated education is superior, does it? I think this is what we really have to think about pretty hard today in New York City. And most of the things which I say, I'm afraid, will refer more to the public schools than they will to your school. But since we are all citizens of New York City and have a real responsibility for what happens to all of the children here, perhaps we can develop some of this sense of wholeness that Ms. Goldsmith has asked us to think about. The first principle that I would like to state is this: that we're really not out of the woods on this problem of integration until the color of a person's skin makes no difference. And if we think about that, and I know now that I'm going to alienate, I'm afraid, some of you, but I wish you just try to think about this and keep an open mind and not reject me at this point. If the color of a person's skin makes no difference, then I wonder why we would bus children long distances from home in order to get an integrated school. It seems to me that one of the crying needs in this community is for the people of the community to feel, to come to feel, not to accept it academically, but really have it inside of themselves, that the schools belong to them. And I have no sense that this is the feeling of people in this community, either on the part of the professionals or on the part of the citizens themselves. I mean, taking it generally as a whole. I think it would be real interesting if the public officials in our Board of Education, in our public school system of New York City, could say, yes, our schools are in a hell of a mess. Now, what are we going to do about it? You know? What are we, the citizens of this town, going to do about our schools? We have been carrying on quite an intensive study in a community on the Lower East Side. Every school in this community is on double session, and one of them is on triple session. But when we asked the representative sampling of citizens in this community what their major problems were, school wasn't mentioned as one of them. And yet the schools in this community are very, very inferior. But we don't feel that this is any of our business, is the point that I want to make here. And I think we need to consider very carefully measures which tend to take the school away from the people more than they are. The second principle that I'd like to state is that we're really not out of the woods until all of the children in this city have a chance for a decent, up-to-date education, whether they go to public school or private school. And deprivation, you know, has a way of snowballing. The youngsters in the community who really need the best schools probably have the poorest schools, as a generalization. I'm again cite this one community, that neighborhood that I've been working in, where the living is very, very poor. The homes are substandard. No magazines, no pictures, no beauty. The streets are cluttered up and dirty, filthy. People live piled up on top of each other. And you go into the schools and they look the same way. They're unpainted, the windows are unwashed, the laboratories don't work, they have a bad odor, the teachers feel deprived and, beaten down. And these children, and they have half-day sessions and triple sessions and so forth. The textbooks are old and worn out, 1930 editions, many of them. This has to change. We seem to have enough money in this country for everything except the necessities. I think that we've got to be sure that every youngster in town has a full day of school. And did you ever stop to think that a six-year-old is only going to be six this year? And it's not enough to have a full day of school for this six-year-old next year, you know, or a 10-year-old. If he is on a half day of school this year, he's missed a part of his education forever. We've got to be sure that our schools have well-trained, friendly teachers. The teachers are the only people whom the community gives the responsibility of really knowing about children. They're the only professionals who are certified as knowing about children that every child has to come in contact with, you know. He may run in contact with a good recreation worker or someone else who is certified to know child growth and development. But he has a chance of knowing a teacher. Now, Fritz Radl tells us that he's never known a single delinquent who's known one decent, mature adult, known him in a manner that he trusted him, you know? And yet all of these 9,000 youngsters that are out on the streets today have had many, many teachers. It kind of gives us pause to think, doesn't it? And I'm not blaming the teachers. We've got to be sure that our schools are equipped with the modern gadgets of modern living. I've been sitting here thinking what some of these schools that I've been in would look like, and what the how the youngsters would respond if they had this kind of beauty around them. Books, pictures, music, typewriters, microscopes, magnets, batteries, so on and so forth. Let's think for a few minutes about teachers. What can teachers do to help develop the kinds of boys and girls that we want, that are whole and accepting and outgoing and who have a sense of security about themselves and their world? Lillian Smith tells this, and I'd like to recommend this. If you haven't seen this book, by all means get it and read it. It's a wonderful book, The Journey. It's really an autobiographical book. She tells about the children at her camp and how they would explore, off and on, all summer long, questions about what is, they didn't say it this way, but this was what they were really talking about. What does it mean to be human? How does a human being differ from a dog or a cat or a horse or a chimpanzee? Where are we going? What are we doing here? How did words come to be, you know? These are fascinating subjects for youngsters to explore, and they lead you into all sorts of avenues for learning. I think that we must help our teachers to see that they need to take time, and I'm quite sure we don't need to say that to this group of people, but I think we need to say it to public school teachers, and we need to be sure that we can get the kinds of conditions where this is possible, where they really talk with youngsters. I'm quite aghast as I visit schools to see how little real visiting there is in the classrooms, you know, where the teacher is talking with the children as another human being rather than instructing, laying out something for the group to learn or to do. This, I think, is perhaps one difference in our generation, in a generation or maybe two generations ago. Lillian Smith tells about her grandmother in here who couldn't explore any of these subjects that are really personal and you might say private, you know, because there were so many things that it wasn't nice to talk about. So that whenever you'd get into one of these subjects, grandmother's reply was, stay out and don't talk about it, you know. Well, this, I think we have, this is one of the things which teachers need to learn to do, and we need to do more of it with children. I think we need to recognize a great variety of capacities in the children that we're teaching, and respect all of them equally well. The earthy insight of some of our children who have lived close to the soil and who now are coming to New York City for the first time and have a great deal to give if we respect what it is that they have. The friendly, tentative outreaching of some timid child. The culture, I think we need to recognize the cultural pull which is on all human beings. Let me give you a few statistics that may set you to thinking. We went into these schools and got permission to, by keeping the anonymity of the children, to take some materials off of the permanent record cards. And we found that for purposes of classifying, making a little comparison, we wanted to compare the Puerto Rican children with what we call the native-born children, which we called everyone else except the Puerto Rican children, just for our own purposes, although this there are many, many children in this community from other cultures than Puerto Rican. But the average IQ of the native-born children in the elementary school in this one school was 95. of the Puerto Rican children was 93. This is in the elementary. In the junior high school, the average IQ of the native born was 93 and the Puerto Rican 83. It's a drop, you see, of 10 points by the junior high school age. Now, these weren't the same children. This was a different group of children. Let me give you another category, and then we'll raise some questions about it. The percentage below 80 of the native born at the elementary level was 14%, and of the Puerto Rican was 20%. The percentage below 80 at the junior high school level of the native born was 23%, and of the Puerto Rican, 43%. Now, I don't think for a moment that 43% of the Puerto Rican children at the junior high school level are below 80 or dull. 21% were said to be below 70, which is pretty close to feeble-mindedness. Now, here we have an illustration of not recognizing the cultural pull which is on people. Because these IQs are given in English, and the only thing that they tell us is that is to give us some sense of the youngster's readiness for using English materials, for working in the medium of English rather than in the medium of Spanish. But here we have these things being recorded and pictures being drawn in youngsters' minds. We talked with many youngsters because we interviewed these children. And many of them told us, Barry sitting back there, I remember a conversation with him last year in which he was telling me about one child he had interviewed. He said, you know, this youngster was a very bright youngster. You could tell by talking to him. But he said something to the effect, you know, I'm kind of dumb in school. I don't get along very well. We tend to accept the pictures that other people have of us, especially if those other people are status people. And so this is operating all of the time. Mr. Studer asked me if I'd say just a little bit about what we have been trying to do this year in order to maybe secure some teachers who are of the kind that we've been talking about, who really respect differences and who recognize cultural pull and who love children and are able to work with them in a person-to-person basis. We are working in one school in this neighborhood with 9 teachers who this year, last year they were trained. They were liberal arts graduates who came to NYU to get a teaching certificate and their master's degree as full-time students. At the end of the year, they received their master's degree and their teaching certificate. And they had done community field work in this community. They'd worked in the settlement in the area. They became enough interested in the area that we thought it would be a very fine idea if they could apply the insights and understandings which they had gained about this community by teaching in that community. And also we were interested in following them up a year to see what are some of the problems which first-year teachers in a special services school have as they try to relate to the situations that they face. Well, we've had a very interesting time working with these 9 teachers. And it's been very, very discouraging, primarily because of the inadequacies of materials, the lack of understanding of any need for a school to recognize that education must be different in one community than it is in another community, you know? That really the curriculum of this school could just as well be taking place out on the plains of Kansas someplace as it could be in the Lower East Side of New York, where there are about 65 different nationality groups represented. And to try to get this idea to permeate a school, one little school, has been a very difficult kind of situation to work with. Well, another principle, it seems to me, is that it's one that Miss Goldsmith touched on too, that we're really not out of the woods until we recognize our own defenses and try to develop some built-in flexibility for the defenses which we have. We each of us build up our own mechanisms, and I think the thing we have to be careful of is that they don't get hardened to the point that we're not able to change. This is told so beautifully in an illustration that Lillian Smith gives in this book, in which her gimmick for writing this book is that she's taking a journey and she stops at two motels, and the first motel keeper is a man who believes that all of the books should be burned. This was at the time of Joseph McCarthy. Charlie McCarthy. I always do that. The time of the McCarthy hearings, and McCarthy was his big idol, and the book should be burned, and so forth. Then she stops at this other motel, and she meets Timothy and his wife, Ellen. And they are a wonderful couple. And she begins to ask herself, what has happened in the lives of these two people that has produced such different kinds of individuals? Because both of them grew up in the backwoods of Georgia. They both were very underprivileged, quotes, kind of people in their childhood. But Timothy tells the story of how one night a couple of women drove up a rainy night to the motel, and they went out to greet them, and they found two Negro women in the car, and they said, please could you tell us a place we could stay around here? And Timothy said, well, we have a room you can stay in. And he said one of the Negro women looked at him in such a strange manner that he didn't know what she was thinking. Maybe she thought that he was accosting her. So he got his wife, and she went out to the car, and she said, come on in and stay in the motel. And then when they got them in their room, his wife turned to these women and said, we serve breakfast at 8 o'clock, and if you would like to come, we'd be glad to have you. And Timothy looked at her very strangely. They went back to their own room and were getting ready for bed, and nothing much was said. And he realized that he had just gone halfway, you know, in his acceptance of people. And finally Ellen said to him, there comes a time in a life when if you don't go the second mile, you'll never take another step. You'll sit there the rest of your days justifying why you didn't move. The next thing, last principle I'd like to say a word about is that we're really not out of the woods until every child has a chance to develop and maintain this thing which we call self-respect. And these years, the early years, the elementary school years, when the child is going out from his own home, his own small world into a larger world, are times when there's so much anxiety and so much tenderness which can attend these situations. But I think we fail sometimes to recognize all of the anxiety that is associated with them. We won't have this as long as we have the degree of centralization in our schools that we have, as long as we have the mass approaches to education, as long as we try to standardize things to the degree that we are at the present time, as long as we look upon the IQ as something which is very, very significant. We must learn to look at these things as a whole and to recognize the possibilities for all of these situations that create anxiety. I'd like to read just a very short poem of County Cullen's, which I'm sure some of you know about, which expresses this very well in closing. This is called Incident. Once riding in old Baltimore, heart-filled, head-filled with glee, I saw a Baltimorean looking straight at me. Now I was six. Eight and very small, and he was no whit bigger. And so I smiled, but he poked out his tongue and called me nigger. Now I saw the whole of Baltimore from May until December. Of all the things that happened there, that's all that I remember.